If it's nerdy, we're into it.
Gaming, movies, television, wrestling, comics, whatever. We are Kyle Eckert and Chris Heck, two lifelong friends with a passion for the world of geekery.
And this is the Geek Ketchup Podcast.
Welcome back, Geek Ketchup family. It's a brand new year, and this is our first episode of 2021, but we're still in our second season, and this is Chapter 28. I'm Chris Heck.
And I'm Kyle Eckert.
And today we're making a light speed jump back to a galaxy far, far away to talk about The Mandalorian, its impact on the Star Wars universe, and our thoughts on all of the recent Star Wars announcements that Disney has made regarding the next phase of television, movies, and print.
Before we get started, though, we wanted to send a big thank you to everyone for listening and share that we truly appreciate you choosing to spend your time with us. If you've enjoyed Geek Ketchup, then be sure to hit the subscribe button so you never miss a chapter and leave us a review to let us know how you think we're doing. You can also find us on social media to get updates on the show and content from the world of geekery. Geek Ketchup Podcast on Facebook and YouTube, at Geek Ketchup Pod on Instagram and Twitter. You can find links to all of these accounts in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. There's even links to our Patreon page and PayPal if you'd like to support the show. But the absolute best thing you can do is simply share Geek Ketchup with your friends and family.
So with that out of the way, let's get focused on one of the hottest shows on television right now, The Mandalorian. Brought to us by the minds of Jon Favreau, Dave Filoni, Lucasfilms, and Disney, The Mandalorian introduced us to Din Djarin, an incredibly badass bounty hunter who lives by the strict code of the Mandalore as he navigates the galaxy bringing in wanted criminals for the Hunters Guild. This character was directly inspired by a more famous bounty hunter from the original Star Wars trilogy, Boba Fett, and the lore of the warrior race of the Mandalorians. Din takes us deeper into the Mandalorian way and gives us a much more detailed understanding of how the few that remain are living in the galaxy after the fall of the Empire. The show originally debuted its pilot episode on November 12, 2019, and couldn't have had any more pressure on it. Coming off the heels of a controversial and tumultuous 5 years of Star Wars that saw box office hits and flops from The Force Awakens and Last Jedi to Rogue One and Solo, as well as multiple announced projects getting scrapped, the show was asked to not only stabilize a ship in peril, but to also carry the launch of Disney's new streaming service, Disney Plus, which became available on the same day. So despite everything that was going on with Star Wars as a whole, The Mandalorian was an immediate success with a 92% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes and critical acclaim pretty much across the board. The first season finished in December of 2019, and season 2 just recently wrapped up in December 2020, so today we are going to touch on our initial reactions when season 1 released, but we'll mostly focus on season 2 prior to taking a look at some of the recent Star Wars announcements from last month's Disney investor call. Since pretty much every Star Wars fan has seen the show, we aren't going to break down the episodes quite as deeply as we typically do, but we still want to state that if you have not watched it yet, or have no idea what a Baby Yoda is, then this is your spoiler warning. So Kyle, let's travel back to season 1 for a few minutes, since we never discussed it much on the show last year. We were immediately thrust into the world of Din Djarin as he forcefully collected a bounty with an intense opening action scene that really set the tone for the show. From that moment on, it was 8 packed episodes where Mando rocketed from planet to planet after he accepted a new off-books bounty that got him involved with the remnants of the Empire and introduced him and the world to the Child. A mysterious and absurdly cute being that looks a lot like a baby version of Master Yoda. A connection is made between the two that was absolute magic on screen and truly captivated both the fans and the internet. It was simply impossible to look anywhere and not see Baby Yoda's image attached to memes, merchandise, and much more. In a nutshell, the Empire wants the Child's midichlorian-rich blood for their own experiments, and Mando isn't having it. He seemingly breaks all of his own rules and the faces of anyone who stands in the way of him returning Baby Yoda to the Jedi. So we all watched as new stories were being told with familiar characters in a package that serviced both our nostalgia for the world George Lucas introduced us to, while feeling fresh and even elevated at times. So let me pass it over to you, Kyle. What do you remember about your thoughts of The Mandalorian when it first released, and how good or bad did you think season one was?
So when The Mandalorian first debuted, in that first episode, that first opening scene in the bar, it was just simply amazing. Like that opening scene, I judge a lot of shows on their opening scene, and I put The Mandalorian right up there with just a iconic opening image. And, you know, you can go down the list of Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, I thought Hell on Wheels all had just really powerful opening sequences. And The Mandalorian's right there with him. That bar scene, he comes in, gets in the fight. I can bring you in warm. I can bring you in cold.
Yep.
Like, it just, I literally just said that and then got goosebumps. Like, it was so iconic. And then the rest of the season went along with it. Like, just episode after episode, diving into Star Wars lore and developing more characters and finding little nooks and crannies of a universe or parts of a universe we've never explored. You know, we've seen so much in the Star Wars universe from various movies and books and comics, etc. But it felt like this was like an area, this like bounty hunters Western vibe that we had never truly seen play out. And we were finally getting a taste of it. And I was just eating it all up. And I think fans everywhere were just eating it up.
Yeah, I completely agree about those opening moments and kind of that whole pilot episode just gets you going, gets the heart rate going, sets the tone that Din Djarin is an absolute monster when it comes to being a bounty hunter and fighting and blasting and all of that top tier action. Really fantastic through and through. I don't fawn over things this often, but it just absolutely deserved it. You know, Jon Favreau, we can't say enough about this guy. You know, he brought us Iron Man back in 2008 and completely kicked off the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And he just came through once again completely with something that, you know, was already beloved. Star Wars is so beloved in general by so many. But to me, he took it to a new height, even with the movies that had come out, because there were some issues with those and it kind of split the fan base. But I don't know anybody that doesn't like The Mandalorian, and I really feel like it's taken the step that we all expected years ago when The Force Awakens released.
Yeah, I mean, it's transcendent. It got people into Star Wars that previously had no interest in Star Wars or no interest in, like, sci-fi operas, however you want to, you know, it's a fantasy opera set in a sci-fi setting, however you want to describe Star Wars. Like,
right.
People just kind of pushed it aside. And with the introduction of Mandalorian, bringing on top tier actors and Pedro Pascal, like, yes, we barely got to see his face in season one, but he was still there. And then also bringing in dynamic directors and giving each episode its own unique feel was just masterfully done. Another person I think deserves a lot of credit is Dave Filoni.
Yeah, no doubt. Yep.
Because I think Dave Filoni, in all of season one of The Mandalorian, you know, his work from The Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels and things like that prepared him for The Mandalorian. I think, you know, he has this great vision and passion for what Star Wars is supposed to be and supposed to look like. And through Jon Favreau, did they channel it into a widespread phenomenon?
Right. And a live action.
In a live action, exactly. And I think the combination of the two of them, it's this Dave Filoni has all of the Star Wars knowledge and passion, and Dave Filoni knows how to take that and bring it to the general public.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. I know I've got a couple things probably to touch on here and there, but there's a whole docuseries for season one, and they put out, I think, an episode or two for season two of the behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And you see how close Dave Filoni got to work with George Lucas when they did Clone Wars and things like that. And, I mean, it's almost like he's George Lucas 2.0 and actually better.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that might be a little sacrilege to some people, but, you know, he just gets it.
Yeah.
And he lives it, he breathes it, he's a super fan. You know, it's almost like everything we were told about J.J. Abrams coming into Force Awakens and it didn't quite pan out. You know, it's like Dave Filoni's the real guy.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, and he doesn't have all the glitz and glam, and, you know, doesn't have the name, and that's not a knock on J.J. Abrams per se, but, like, J.J. Abrams was a name.
Right.
You know, when he came to Star Wars, I think very few people outside of the Clone Wars and Rebels, and he did Avatar The Last Airbender, directed a few episodes there. Like, the animated community knew about Dave Filoni, but the general public did not, versus when J.J. Abrams come in, he comes in because he had already revitalized Star Trek, Lost, he was a name, so he was almost... It was Star Wars and J.J. Abrams next to each other versus Dave Filoni really just wants to push Star Wars. He doesn't want the spotlight, which I guess is a jab on J.J. Abrams, you know, that he wants to take a little bit of the spotlight. But
yeah,
I just think it was all so well done and just delivered throughout.
Yeah, I really came away from season one and really even almost like the first episode thinking back on it, you know, and if anybody has listened to me, knows my thoughts on Star Wars, you know, I was frustrated with the recent trilogies and the Skywalkers and the Death Stars and just all this stuff that we just keep getting repeatedly over and over again, kind of in the same but different package. And my overall sense was, you know, straight up, this was the Star Wars I had been looking for.
Yeah.
I have no problem with some of the nostalgia and stuff, but we don't have to stay locked into the same things we've been seeing for 40 and 50 years now. Whereas, you know, I think that's one of the highlights of this show is that they are scratching the itches that we have from this world without pandering.
Yeah.
It's not force-feeding, you know, necessarily the old on us. Even though we see some of the old.
Yeah.
Because they do it in very different ways. They do it in more creative ways, in my opinion. And, you know, it all just kind of adds up to the breath of fresh air that I think a lot of us expected when they originally announced that they were going to bring, you know, Star Wars back in a big way to the, you know, big screen and finish the trilogy and all of that. But I also kind of wanted to touch on here before we move on, was there was a really funny day, you know, I think it was episode 2 when they revealed the child.
Yeah.
And I believe I was the first to watch it. And literally when they revealed him at the end and you see that he is like, you know, baby Yoda, my jaw hit the floor, went into my downstairs, went down to the core of the earth, into the pit of hell. I mean, my jaw could not have fallen off my face any further than it did. And I literally just grabbed my phone and like snapped a selfie and sent it to our group of friends. And then, you know, it was funny because as everybody kept watching it, you know, you all started snapping pics too.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, think back on that. Like the fact that that did not get leaked, the fact that nobody outside of that project had a freaking clue that they were going to bring in a character like this was kind of a miracle in itself. But I don't know if you want to touch on that, but I just, that's going to be like an all-time TV moment for me because it blew my mind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's crazy, and we'll get into it a little later, but The Mandalorian and Favreau and Filoni and everyone that works on this show clearly knows what they're doing on how to keep something secret in 2020, 2021, in the modern era of television, because they did it again, you know, in season 2 for us. But like I said, we'll get to that. But that moment, it really is, because it's the introduction of Baby Yoda, you know, goes on to be known as Grogu, as we find out in season 2. But it becomes the character, you know, as much as the show is about the Mandalorian, Baby Yoda at the time made the show, and it was everywhere. There were so many questions like, wait, basically he's 50 years old. People were looking at the timeline like, oh, he would have been alive during the prequels. Where was he? And this and that, like what's going on? It provoked so many questions and got so many people thinking and so many people talking. You're right. It's going to live on forever because it's one of those moments, you know, who shot JR,
right?
And, you know, type moments in television history that just everybody's talking about. So people that had no interest are flocking to the show because everybody's talking about it. Everybody wants to know. There's so many questions.
Yeah.
So it piques my interest and I got to go see what is this thing about.
Well, and he's just so damn cute.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned it kind of in the opening, like I think that was another reason was they did so good with the imagery and the puppet and he was just so dang cute that, you know, whether you were like a housewife who didn't even know what Star Wars was or a super fan, I mean, he was getting put into memes like Bernie Sanders is, you know, this week. Mitten Bernie Sanders is everywhere. You know, last year it was literally Baby Yoda in everything. And it was really just cool to see how a character that barely says anything, that isn't even human or an actor, it could be so captivating.
Yeah.
Maybe even more captivating than the original Yoda.
Whew, yeah.
That might be an argument or a discussion for another day, but questionable, you know?
I think there are points to be made if you wanted to go down that route, but it's true. And you said, like, with very little to say, in fact, doesn't speak at all. It's just baby noises and, right. You know, a little like, noises and slurps when it's eating and things like that. Like, yeah, it draws your attention. Every scene that Baby Yoda was in that first season, your eyes were on it. And I joke with The Incredibles 2. That's how Jack was for me in the second Incredibles movie. Like, stole the screen. Like, it didn't matter what else was happening around. You wanted your eyes on that character in the scenes that it got, because it was always doing something funny or, you know, mischievous, and it just goes down in history. And, you know, once the merchandise started to come out, no one was surprised that it took off like the way it did.
Yeah. So at the end of season one, we pretty much see kind of a continuation. It's very much kind of a to be continued part of the story. You know, Mandalorian does not finish his mission with Baby Yoda at the end of season one. They kind of just up the stakes and cut it off, and, you know, it was 8 episodes, and we all had to wait another year to get it to come out. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, I think at first we weren't sure if we were going to get Mandalorian again, you know, season two last year because of COVID and production stops and things like that. But, you know, they were able to get it done. So it was really one of the highlights of television in general that we got out of 2020, just because there was so many less releases and new shows and things like that, new seasons. But when we get into season two, and so we're going to shift over to that now and kind of take a look at what happened in a little bit more detail. You know, we pretty much start out right away. Mando's still on the quest. He's got to get information on where the Jedi are. He needs to get information potentially on where other Mandalorians are who could help him with that. And we see him, you know, walking into a really shady underground kind of fight club to open season one. And it was a different feel than to open season two. And it was a different feel than what we got in season one, but still had some of that same tone, same intensity. You know, he's dealing with shady mob boss type characters.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some action, you know, he's going to get what he wants regardless of what happens. And so he's dealing with this like Cyclops one eye kind of fat, you know, mob boss. And I don't know if you knew this, but in the documentary, when I watched it on season two, that mob boss character was actually John Leguizamo.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I had seen that, like, in a classic Star Wars move to hide a famous actor behind a helmet or makeup. Like, I'm thinking Simon Pegg when he was in, I believe, Force Awakens. Like, they hit him by so much makeup and CG, you couldn't tell it was him. But that's perfect to pull in a top-notch actor to play somebody that's really only on screen for, what, like 6 minutes?
Yeah, something like that, 6-10 minutes. But I saw that and I was like, that's super cool. I love John Leguizamo. He always does a good job. And I think he's kind of tight with Favreau or some of those guys. So it probably was probably made a lot of sense. But, you know, of course, as he always does, Din gets the information he's looking for. He definitely bloodies up the fight club. He leaves, you know, the Cyclops hanging from a pole and kind of walks out of this, you know, really shady underground kind of world. And he gets some information that sends him back to Tatooine.
Yeah.
And this was super cool because this is, you know, like I was mentioning, this is a situation where, okay, we saw Tatooine in season one. We've seen Tatooine multiple times throughout Star Wars, you know, television and movies and everything. It's a very important world.
Yeah.
But when we get here, they immediately send him over to a different port. He lands in Mos Eisley, which we've seen, but they send him out to Mos Palos or something along those lines, but a different side of the planet.
Yeah.
And he runs into a marshal played by Timothy Oliphant, another big name actor, you know, jumping in here for a little bit.
Danny Cordray for the Office fans.
Yeah, Danny. There you go. And surprisingly, we get another turn here, another reveal, and the Marshal is wearing legitimately Boba Fett's armor.
Oh, yeah. And I love, because the one-eyed, you know, the mobster, he kind of says, like, I heard that there are Mandalorians on Tatooine. And it's kind of funny because I feel like it's a little bit of a fourth wall where the Mandalorian, like Mando says, I've spent time on Tatooine and I've never seen a Mandalorian.
Right.
And but like you as a fan, it's like, ooh, no, there is a Mandalorian on Tatooine. Like you just, you know, he's just dead in a Sarlacc pit.
Right.
and so there was just like pieces of excitement. And it's something the Mandalorian as a show does really well, like taking nuggets and then making you remember and then getting really excited about it.
Right. And that was really put on display, you know, beyond the armor piece, right? It kind of leads to a standoff. And of course, Mando wants the armor back. Timothy Oliphant is looking for some help. He's willing to make the deal and give the armor back so long as they help him with a problem. And that problem is to take down a, you know, I don't even know, 400-foot giant monster crate dragon.
Yeah.
Which was another obscure reference that we only got in a scene or two from A New Hope, where Obi-Wan's talking about, you know, crate dragons being on Tatooine and how they scare the sand people. And we get to see this really come to life in this epic battle. They work closely with the sand people, so they kind of humanize them a little more.
Oh, yeah.
And give us some more feel for a race that has typically been kind of seen as like throwaway or menacing. And so they just did a lot right there in that first episode to take us to places we hadn't been, give us some hope for some things that people have always loved in Boba Fett, and make an entire group of characters that everybody knows about significantly deeper than they ever were.
Oh, yeah. Like, I loved what they did with the sand people throughout The Mandalorian and really humanizing them, because all they did in the original trilogy and even the prequels to some extent was show them as these, you know, evil, like horde-like beings. They just take and kill and raid and nothing else. And then you come to find out, no, they are like an entire culture.
Yep.
And the way that they sign to each other to communicate, which, and a bit of a side note, they actually brought in deaf actors to play those sand people on that particular episode, which is like really well done as well. And just kind of, like you said, humanize this group of people in the Star Wars universe that has never been humanized before, showing the other side of it. Showing that it's not just good and evil.
Yep.
Just, and it's all your perspective. And if you can change your perspective and interact with these folks, you can see that they have families and developed a civilization. I think there's a moment, you know, where Cobb Vance and his town don't want to work with the sand people. And Mando is basically like, no, you do. There's a reason this civilization has survived for thousands of years in the desert.
Right.
They know the land, they know the territory, and they know what they're doing out here, and you're going to need to work together.
Yep.
If we want to keep this planet safe.
Yeah, so you get some really cool action scenes. Ultimately, you know, Mando is able to get the job done. He's able to reclaim that Beskar armor, and, you know, but he doesn't find his Mandalorian. He's got to continue his trek. He heads back to his ship, and it kind of sets up episode two, because there we see, you know, he's introduced to a kind of like a frog lady. It's an alien race. She's like half lizard, half frog kind of looking like. And she needs passage to another planet to take her eggs to her husband so they can do their thing and make sure that they hatch and keep their bloodline going. But, you know, ultimately he's kind of reluctant because he's not an Uber.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't usually take people on, but she says that her husband knows where, you know, there are Mandalorians for sure on that planet. So he agrees. Ultimately, I thought that this episode was one of a couple, a small handful of episodes through the series so far that are borderline throwaway. They always have done good jobs with, you know, something progresses in every episode, which is a plus.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you can almost take these as like little standalones. You know, nothing too drastic is happening. But we've got some cool stuff here. You know, the ship's kind of messed up and they can't use hyperdrive.
Light speed.
Because it'll kill the eggs. So they have to, you know, go old school and take their time, which leads to a run-in with the X-Wings and the sheriffs of the New Republic. You know, obviously Mando's kind of on the run, so he doesn't want to deal with the authorities. So he goes on a crazy, you know, flight spaceship chase. That was a really cool scene.
Yeah.
And ends up on a glacier planet. It really looked like Hoth at first, very snowy covered, white. But in the behind the scenes, they actually talk about how they made it more of like an ice planet with glacier kind of properties versus just snow. And ultimately, you know, they end up down in like they crash land into a cavern, and we get this crazy scene with these giant spiders, you know, that look kind of like squid spiders, you know, attacking them, and they barely make it out. But that's kind of the gist of all we got in episode two, was some cool action, kind of a little bit of a peril, and then ultimately they're able to make it on their way. So one of my few knocks on the show is that there are a couple of these episodes peppered in, and being that it's only 8 episodes, I don't like having a wasted episode in a way. Maybe wasted isn't the right term. I think you kind of know where I'm getting at, but
yeah.
But it's almost like I need every episode to be producing more plot points, to be forwarding the story, and they've got a couple peppered in that don't quite do that.
Yeah.
At least not for me.
No, and I agree with you 100%, like, and I kind of have this down, you know, as one of the few knocks on the show is because of the nature of it, of this bounty hunter Western feel, go to a new town, help that town, then move on, and then there's just get subtle movement in the overall plot. You know, that is very classic Western series, and I believe the last time we did talk about Mandalorian, I compared it to The Rifleman.
Sure, yeah.
Which is like an older black and white show where, you know, there is an overall plot that's happening that just inches along episode by episode, but the majority of the plot of each episode is dedicated to whatever planet or town that, you know, the main character is currently helping. So you're right. With only 8 episodes a season, most of them are 40 minutes each. Like, especially in season 1, they were like 30 to 50 minutes each. We got a couple longer ones in season 2 that went 45 to an hour. But you want more of it. But at the exact same time, it does seem to be like seasoned correctly, to put it that way, where like it's not overpowering each episode, but it is just enough there that, you know, you're not just going to stop watching.
Yeah.
You know, it moves the needle just a hair to want you to go back in for that next bite.
And I agree. It's just more a couple nitpicky things. If I had to choose some items that I don't like quite as much or some critiques, you know, it kind of falls more into the realm of that.
Yeah.
Obviously hasn't stopped me from absolutely, you know, praising the show and loving, you know, pretty much every minute of it. Because even in those episodes, you still get great action. And here, you know, the spiders that they brought out, the ice spiders, were actually something that was designed for previous Star Wars movies, I think back for Empire, if I remember the documentary right, but they never made it in.
Oh.
And it never got used. So they kind of dug this design for this, you know, alien spider enemy. And because they were white and things like that, they thought it would fit the nature of this ice planet. And so they got to bring something that one of the creators from, you know, 50 years ago almost had put together and bring that to life. So it still had some cool moments and some cool aspects to it. But, you know, kind of to your point too, one of the other items I had here that, you know, I'd like to see them maybe tweak a little bit or maybe get a little more creative is, you know, almost every episode opens with him coming to a new planet or being on a new planet, and then it ends with him leaving to go to another planet. And so while it's not terrible and it fits what they're doing, it's just one of those things of like, does it have to be the exact same every time?
Yeah.
You know, and if we're going to get 3, 4, 5, 6 seasons of the show, which I don't know if we will, but if we do, maybe like to see him just kind of play with that a little bit, you know, and mix it up a little bit or whatever it may be.
And that could come down to the production style, because you typically see a different director each episode. And so coming to a new planet and putting them in a new environment every single episode allows them to change the stylistic approach of that particular episode.
That's a good point.
To fit the director. Now, as the seasons, you know, go on and the show expands, we might see that less. We might see Filoni gets like the first three episodes because they all take place on one planet. And then
We
bop over and we let, you know, Deborah Chow, she directs, you know, two or three. And then Ron Howard's daughter, Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yeah.
She gets a block of episodes. So I think if they were to take that approach, they would have to change how they produce the show.
That's true. And it's totally fair. It's just more of like, if there's anything that kind of comes to mind, you know, these are a few of those little nitpicky things, you know?
Yeah.
Not everything can be 100% perfect, you know, but they're close. They're close.
I mean, yeah. Like I said, it's not going to be 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's a 92.
Yeah. Yeah. So next up, you know, they manage to get off the ice planet. They survive the spiders and they pretty much limp their way to, it's really kind of like a port city, and the planet, it makes sense that the frog lady wants to get here because the planet is pretty much covered entirely in water.
Yeah.
So it's very amphibious, and they do find her husband. She does come through on the promise of informing him that there are other Mandalorians on this planet. And so, you know, Mando goes seeking him out. He gets kind of in some trouble with a squid race of people that are trying to essentially take his Beskar. So they get him into a pickle with the kid. And we see another big reveal. And this time is a huge one for anybody that had watched Clone Wars, because we see three Mandalorians come to the rescue. And one of them is Bo-Katan.
The drop in on that in the hype level was real, because that does date back to Clone Wars, and then she was also in Star Wars Rebels. Like, oh man, the feels when they come flying in with the dual blasters and just, I mean, go full Mandalorian.
Yep.
Because that is the Mandalorian might. We got it in season one when they broke out of the covet and helped him escape the planet. And then this was kind of an equal scene when they come flying down on the ship. And we see, you know, WWE shout out Sasha Banks.
Yes, making her debut.
Yeah. Make her debut. And that entire sequence is awesome, because you really see what, you know, we've seen all along what one Mandalorian can do.
Right.
And then we got the scene where you got like 15 and they just dominated.
Yeah.
And then we got these action sequences where it's like three or four and they're just wrecking house. Like it was chef's kiss.
Oh, because they're all like pretty much like Navy SEAL, Special Forces,
yeah,
SEAL Team 6 kind of folks. Like, they're trained at that level. So any one of them, yeah, is just a wrecking ball, no matter what he's up against or she's up against. So you start getting a small team together or a whole platoon of them, and you can see how they did, you know, in the lore, how they really, you know, fought the Empire for a long time before, and even the Jedi way back when,
yeah,
without really being conquered for a long, long time. Ultimately, of course, it went a little bit south with the Empire, but they were able to really hold the lines and keep up with it. So, you know, there's obviously some interesting moments between the two Mandalorians. I thought it was funny when Bo-Katan takes off her helmet and, you know, Mando is just like, "What are you doing?" You
know,
because he hasn't met other Mandalorians that operate differently from the foundling way and his group of Mandos that trained him.
Yeah.
You know, they have kind of a stricter code. And so it creates some interesting dynamics, starts to challenge his beliefs and what it actually means to be a Mandalorian and all of those kinds of things. But he ultimately has to help Boca and her folks, you know, take over a Imperial freighter full of weapons. So we see another cool set of action scenes there. But after, you know, successfully helping her, Boca points Din in the direction of the one Jedi that she's aware of that's, you know, still out in the galaxy, and she tells him to go find Ahsoka Tana on the forest planet of Corvus.
Yeah, and this Star Wars Clone Wars faithful are just getting everything they've ever wanted, you know, from a live-action Bo-Katan, and then the drop that Mando is a child of the Watch, which is a throwback to the Death Watch, you know, arcs in Clone Wars. to then finding out that we're going to see a live action debut of Ahsoka Tano. Like, oh my, whew, chills, shivers, the excitement is building. Oh yeah.
Well, and it was really impressive that they were able to take something, even going back to season one, I mean, the hype meter just constantly ticks up, you know, it's well past 11 at this point, you know, because almost every episode or every couple episodes, you're just getting these giant reveals, these big fan services, but, you know, for characters that we haven't seen on the live screen before. And so giving that, the fact that it's released, you know, episodically once a week, I mean, it felt like as soon as every episode ended, you were like, God, need the next one right now.
Right, yeah. Well, that was my point with, like, the even the throwaway, quote-unquote, episodes, like the glacier and the spiders and all that. Like, you still get these hints, and you're like, no, I just need it. I need it right now. I don't want to wait. 7 days is too much.
Yep.
And just this, the name drop, you know, when she name drops Ahsoka. You're like, it's happening.
Yeah.
It's really, really happening. Expanding on lore of a character that we don't get too much. You know, she pops up here and there. You know, we got a lot out of her in Clone Wars. But then there was the big question, okay, well, Clone Wars happens and she isn't mentioned in the original trilogy.
Right.
How is that possible? And then, you know, here, she's going to come back. But like, wait, so she survived the entire original trilogy? And where was she? Like,
yeah.
But still, like, you have faith in the producers and the creators of the show because they essentially invented these characters that they're going to do justice and they're going to do right.
It'll be exciting to see how the casual fans and the long-term fans that, you know, watch the movies but haven't watched Clone Wars or haven't followed, you know, the animated stuff as closely or at all, not familiar with Ahsoka. It'll be interesting to see how they take her.
Yeah.
Because you're now putting her front and center. And if you're not familiar, you know, Ahsoka was essentially Anakin Skywalker's Padawan.
Right.
And they wrote her into this really kind of prominent role before Anakin became Vader. And yet, you know, like you said, she wasn't in the original movies. Nobody's really seen her till, you know, this season of the show. But before he can get there to Corvus, you know, episode four, we have another one of those kind of in-between episodes. Mando knows that his ship is just absolutely wrecked. The Razor Crest is borderline non-functional.
Yeah.
He just barely gets it together enough to get off of the ice planet. And so he goes back to Nevarro where Cara Dune and Carl Weathers Grief Karga, you know, are still hanging out and have been running that place. So he goes back to the friends that he met in season one. He knows he's got to get some ship repairs, and then obviously he gets roped in like he always does into helping them with the problem. Everybody in the galaxy's got problems, and it's kind of cool because Nevarro is like a lava planet.
Yeah.
You know, it has lava that like flows like rivers, and they talk about the lava tides and things like that, so it's kind of like water. But there's a Empire base that is still there, and they think it's kind of just full of supplies and could be a target for smugglers and black market stuff. So they want to take it out, destroy it all, so that way they can have kind of peace and keep everything law and order. So they go on this mission to attack this base, and they find there that it's actually more than what it seems. And it's not just old weapons. It's actually a active base being used by Moff Gideon, one of the big bads that they're dealing with from the Empire, one of kind of like the last remnants of the Empire. And it's really like a science research facility. And we see these test tubes full of like deformed kind of humanoid clones.
Yeah.
And it kind of brings into view why they want the child and his midichlorian rich blood. It kind of gives you the impression that they're trying to create new force sensitive beings, you know, I guess new Siths or new Jedis essentially that they can then control.
Yeah, oh yeah, and like I think they go into the base saying it's a skeleton crew, basically a couple stormtroopers and maybe a few droids, but it ends up being like an entire platoon.
Right.
But I love all of, like, they haven't given us much of what they're doing with Grogu's blood, because I think there's a hint at the beginning of this episode where they show the scene with the scientist.
Yeah.
And he's talking about how they're completely out of the original set of, you know,
samples.
Like the donor. Yeah. They call it the donor samples, but really it's Grogu's DNA, Baby Yoda's DNA there, and they need to get more. So you find out all of this stuff, and I'm really hoping that in future seasons or later down the line, we get a little more of this, of what are they trying to do here?
Right.
Because that one thing that is noticed in season one is that scientist, he has a Kamino's cloner's patch on his uniform, which means he's learned from the same group of people that made the clones for the Clone War. So, like, what are they trying to do? Are they trying to make more Force-sensitive people? Are they just trying to boost their own regime? Are they trying to make elevated stormtroopers? How is this going to work out? And I think these little seeds hopefully pay off in the long run.
Yeah, especially as we start to see, and we'll talk about it on the back end, but, you know, all the announcements and all these other IPs and shows and stuff that are coming, they really could get deep into some of this stuff. So we'll have to see. But, you know, that was kind of the halfway point when they finish up on Nevarro and he gets everything squared away. He is able to fly off and head towards Corvus, where he was told Ahsoka is. One detail that we see as the viewer, but Mandalorian doesn't have any idea about, is that he's betrayed a little bit because Moff Gideon had essentially like a spy or a contact on the planet.
Yeah.
And so when that guy is actually a ship repairman, is working on the ship, he kind of tags it with a tracker. So it's kind of one little piece that lets us know that, okay, at some point we're coming back to a head here and they're all going to come together. But before that, you know, he does get out, he does head over to Corvus. And I thought that this was kind of cool because it kind of turned the tone a little bit, and mostly because of the environment, you know, and maybe it's a good time to stop here and just say that Star Wars has always been great with their environment crafting. You know, a lot of the planets are very unique and have some cool visuals and culture and things like that. But I feel like one thing we've seen in the more recent movies and now in Mando is kind of just taking that to the next level and going deeper and really sparing no expense on how these planets look to make sure that you feel like, okay, these are unique. Each one of these worlds, even though they fit into this galaxy, they are all dealing with their own problems and their own issues and the whole nine yards. So when we go into this scene for episode 5, it is desolate. It is bleak. It's dark. I mean, it's a forest planet, but it looks like the entire forest has been burned or cut, you know, harvested.
Yeah.
There's ash just floating through the air, you know, like rain essentially. And there's, you know, a city that is pretty much slave to the Empire, a magistrate of the Empire. And we see a pretty cool opening scene. It was a good introduction to Ahsoka because there's a little platoon of people. They're out there trying to hunt her down. And, you know, in these dark shadows, you see, you know, white lightsabers come flying up. And, like, that's all you see in all this smoke and darkness. And then they go away. And she's like a ninja, stealth moving around these guys, taking them out one by one. And you just know, pretty much the same way that they told us right off the bat, no questions, that Din Djarin is a badass.
Yeah.
You know immediately that Ahsoka is the real deal.
Absolutely. Actually, the opening sequence of this particular episode gave me almost a horror movie type vibe.
That's fair, yeah.
Like, yeah, with the burnt ash and, like, I actually thought it was snow. You know, the first time you watch it, you're like, is it snowing? But you're right, like, it's burnt ash coming down, the burnt forest, everything's dark, and she's hunting. She's a predator,
yep.
You know, going for her prey. And, of course, in this situation, she's got the lightsaber, so we're rooting for her. But it was this entire episode had that theme where it slowed down and made dramatic, tense moments that I likened to a horror film.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. And I mean, pretty much start to finish, it fits into that. You know, ultimately, Ahsoka and the magistrate are at odds. Ahsoka wants information from the magistrate. And then, of course, you know, the Mandalorian kind of just comes into all of this and he doesn't really know. Yeah, he doesn't know anything about it. He's just here. So he's trying to like get some information from the people of the town. He kind of sees that something is not right. It's very much not a free and open town. People aren't even talking to him. And the magistrate ultimately recognizes, okay, I've got a Mandalorian here, and the Mandalorians historically are, you know, the enemies of the Jedi. So she tries to get him to go after Ahsoka.
Yeah.
And so that leads to a kind of a cool little fight. We get a few minutes of Ahsoka and Mando fighting it out a bit. But once she sees, you know, Baby Yoda, Grogu, who we're about to learn is his name, but once she sees him, she kind of stops and she's like, can we talk about him?
Yeah, right.
You know, and it changes the course of everything.
Yeah, I like the fight sequence because you really see the extent of Mando's Beskar armor.
Yeah.
And that Beskar can stand up to a lightsaber in all forms. Like, we also see in this particular episode, he agrees to go after Ahsoka, agrees to go after the Jedi, and his payment will be a Beskar, a pure Beskar spear.
That's right, yep.
And so it's like that, like, okay, that could be a weapon that you could really use to fight a lot of things. But then you also see that his Beskar armor on his arms and shoulders can also withstand a lightsaber slice,
yeah.
Which I think is huge in the lore of Beskar and why the Mandalorians were at odds with the Jedi for so long and able to kind of go toe-to-toe with them.
Right, yeah, I thought that was really cool to see. And they didn't spare any detail. Like, you even, like, when she's swinging that lightsaber at him and he's putting up his pauldrons, you know, like, on his forearms trying to block it, you see, like, sparks flying off, and you actually see the Beskar getting red.
Yeah.
Like, you see, like, red-hot steel, that bright orange glow. And so they actually, like, built that in to the effect. So, and then when she takes it off, it cools down. It goes back to normal. Like, it was really well done to almost highlight, like you said, like, highlight the Beskar even more than maybe anything else in that fight.
Yeah.
Like, that whole scene may have been just about establishing that fact, you know, no doubts that Beskar is this strong.
Yeah, it has some moments before this. Like, I think especially on the mission that they went on with Bo-Katan, like, he pulls himself in real tight and runs through the corridor and probably takes, like, 15 shots, like, to the armor from stormtroopers.
That's true.
You see Beskar at its full might before, but in Star Wars, there's really nothing more powerful than a lightsaber.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a Palpatine lightning blast.
Right.
Like, defeats it. But outside of that, like, the lightsaber is the end-all be-all of weapons in the Star Wars universe. And here we see something that our main protagonist has an entire armor set made of something that can withstand a lightsaber slice.
Yeah, because we'll see him, you know, take lightsabers, cut straight through droids. You know, there's a couple scenes where they use them to, like, melt doors or cut them like, you know, plasma torches would or like a welder's torch, you know?
Yeah.
And then you see this steel, and as long as it's pure, it ain't having any of that. So it was super cool. I have to stop here, though, and say, seriously, like, what are your thoughts on the name Grogu? Because we get that moment, you know, Ahsoka connects with Baby Yoda. She's able to communicate him, you know, and feel his thoughts through the Force and have the ability to learn a little bit more about his past, what happened to him, the fact he's kind of been in hiding since Order 66 and all that went down, I guess, with the Jedi's getting turned on.
Yeah.
But what did you think when they said Grogu?
I didn't love it. You know, and as time went on, as the season went on, it becomes normalized and it's not such a big deal. But, you know, right there in the beginning, it's like, really, Grogu? Like, that's the name? And I know a handful of people are like, yeah, no, it's Baby Yoda.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not calling him Grogu. No, he's Baby Yoda and Baby Yoda forever. And so, I was upset, and then eventually I got over it because I really started to think, well, what else is it going to be? You know, it's not going to be Yaddle.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if you remember. Yeah. I don't know if you remember the encyclopedia book for Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
Like, but there was that secondary, like, at this point, Grogu's only the third canon character to look of this species. And so there was Yoda and Yaddle. So what was it going to be like? I don't know. Yiddle? Like, what was it? YOLO? Like, what was it going to be? So I think it was a tough spot because I don't think you're going to please everybody with this. But, you know, Grogu now, at the end of the season's ended, and I've said Grogu about 1,000 times, that I'm okay with it.
Yeah, that's fair, and I probably fall somewhere similar, but I know when she first said it, I was like, ew.
Yeah.
It just didn't seem to fit the character they had built, and
yeah,
honestly, it struck me more as a dark side kind of name, and so I don't know if we'll go down this path, but there was a part of me when I heard that just kind of thought, maybe this is going to be Dark Side Yoda, you know, and he's going to turn out to end up being more full of fear and hate and kind of the whole nine yards. Maybe not, but I think that would be pretty cool if they did that and had the balls to take something so beloved and, you know, give it a heel turn.
There was a lot of, you know, controversy over that idea just for Luke in the new trilogy.
That's true.
You know, like, are they... Especially with what they did in The Last Jedi, where, like, he wasn't quite the happy-go-lucky, you know, Luke Skywalker that we remembered, you know, always looking to the sunset and looking for an adventure. Like, he wasn't that person anymore, and that got some fan backlash. So, maybe they will, maybe they won't, time will tell, but I could see that. Grogu does sound very dark side, and it would fit in this moment where Ahsoka talks about how for so long he's had to hide his powers and not use them. And that's caused a lot of fear and anxiety within him.
Right.
So that could all wrap up together real nicely.
Well, and I think that was some of why I started to think about that, was she was kind of mentioning some of those things that are typically associated with going dark side. So we'll have to see. I think there's a lot more, you know, to come with that story. The only thing I will say is I just want to know, so if, you know, if Grogu was around, what happened to him? Like, we need to know more about that in-between period and who he was being trained by and what other Jedi he is aware of. You know, I think there's some more questions to be answered there with that character, especially looking at the fact that, you know, we hadn't seen him before.
Yeah.
Time periods and all of that. But anyway, so ultimately, you know, obviously Mando wants to get Grogu trained, so he wants Ahsoka to take him and train him. She pretty much kind of denies that because she's seen what can happen when strong entities with the Force, you know, are full of fear and anxiety and all that kind of stuff. It
doesn't
go well. Keep in mind, you know, Darth Vader was her master before he was Darth Vader.
And she even says, she even says, I've seen what it can do even to the best of us.
Right, exactly.
You know, that it can turn it. Also, the fact that she's not technically a Jedi.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so spoiler alert for the Clone Wars, people that haven't watched the Clone Wars, she leaves the Jedi Order.
Oh, okay.
And leaves, and that's like kind of part of her story arc. I don't want to go too much into it for, you know, if people are listening to this and then also interested in Clone Wars. Yeah, but she is technically not a Jedi.
Okay.
She is Force sensitive and clearly has a lot of training, but she left the Jedi Order and was never granted the rank of Jedi Knight.
Okay. Well, if you're listening and that was spoiler for you, don't feel bad because that was spoiler for me because I am in the midst of my first watch of Clone Wars, so thank you, Kyle. Appreciate
I know.
That.
I felt bad because I knew that. I knew that you're watching. But, like, I don't think it interrupts. It's not going to ruin, you know, because
it's so
her story arc, her story arc in Clone Wars is still really good. So I am going to highly recommend you going out there and watching it. But that does happen. So I felt like there was some hesitation on her part because she herself, while, of course, she's gone on and grown up and mastered her abilities for sure, at the core of it, she's technically not a Jedi. And she has a line right there where she says, there are few Jedi left.
Yeah, that's true.
And she doesn't say there's a few of us left.
She does kind of talk about them like they are somebody else. Yeah. So of course, you know, just to wrap up here with episode 5, he's trying to make the deal with her. So, of course, she's got a problem that she needs help solved. And that is to go and pretty much liberate the city and get the information she's looking for from the magistrate. So we get another pretty sweet action scene. And kind of the highlight, though, was her battle with the magistrate, because the magistrate has clearly been trained in combat and she has that Beskar spear and she knows how to wield it. So we get a really cool scene of dual lightsabers against that Beskar spear, which, you know, once again kind of shows off and previews how effective that steel can be against things like lightsabers. So they ultimately do accomplish their goal, and Ahsoka points Mando in the direction of a kind of a Jedi temple or monument type deal.
Right.
They call it the Seeing Stone. It's like a natural rock formation. If you kind of think about like a satellite dish, there's like a center sphere.
Yeah.
And then there's these big towering flat rock faces that are all kind of pointing in a symmetrical circle. And so they pretty much take us to that planet. It's called Tython. So episode 6 opens up with them pretty much flying in. You get this nice aerial shot of this formation where he's got to take Grogu, and they march their way up there. Mandalorian doesn't really know what he's doing. You know, he has no idea truly what's going on with the Jedi and all their kind of religious stuff and their artifacts and things like that. So he sets Grogu down on the sphere. Not too much happens, and then boom, Grogu pretty much reaches out through the Force, so he's kind of locked in place, he's helpless, and then all of a sudden things start popping off because we see a ship come into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And just like in episode 1, it's something that we have seen before. It is Slave 1, Boba Fett's ship,
yep,
flying in, and everybody is just like, what is about to happen?
Yeah, like Boba Fett is back. And we saw like the preview of him back in episode 1 when he was leaving Tatooine and his ship was flying away. And
that's true.
There
was
kind of like that body, but and it was the actor that played Jango, obviously, because Boba is a clone of Jango and not like his direct son, just a clone. And so you knew he was going to come back.
Right.
After that reveal, you're like, oh, snap. Like, he's in the universe. He is alive. Patton Oswalt called it. And Parks and Rec, you know, the clawed Mandalorian armor, like, climbs out of the Sarlacc pit. We didn't get to see that, but we know that it did happen. We know that he's alive. And when that ship flies in, it's on, baby. It's on. Because you don't know why he's there.
Right, right. Yeah, we don't know why he's there, but he does come up. He does confront Mando, and we also see that the assassin Fennec, who was a character that we saw and was introduced to in season 1, who we thought died, we see that she is still alive, and now she's partnered with Boba because he had pretty much saved her life, and they pretty much are there for Boba's armor, you know, for one, but they offer to essentially help Mando with his mission, you know, to protect the child and get him where he needs to go. But they really aren't able to get into it too much, because right after that, thinking back to that tracker that got placed on the Razor Crest, Moff Gideon sends in pretty much multiple platoons of stormtroopers, and all hell breaks loose.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Grogu is still, you know, minutes later, completely helpless, calling out through the Force. And so we see, I don't even know, 20, 30, 50, it's dozens and dozens of stormtroopers come and assault this mountain. And, you know, Boba, Fennec, and Mando, you know, are holding them off. And we get some of the most badass, I'm talking full tilt badassery, epic in every sense, with Boba Fett making his grand return, just taking out everything in his path. He's doing it with his hands. He's doing it with his big
spear,
kind of tribal, the spear club kind of look. He eventually runs off and grabs his armor and comes back, and it just makes him even more intense. And they pretty much gave him every ounce of writing and attention and, you know, in this scene. And I thought it was really cool because I forget the director's name, but in the documentary, they talked about how, like, his approach to this scene was, I don't know if Boba's ever going to make it back on screen.
Right.
You know, he didn't know. He wasn't going to rely on Boba being around long term. So he wanted to make sure that we got Boba Fett in all the glory.
Yeah. Well, and it pays homage. Like we said, one of the things The Mandalorian does so well is it takes these little nuggets of information or characters that we love from the past of Star Wars and gives them a moment to shine. So Boba Fett, in all of his, like, what, 10 minutes of screen footage across the three original movies, he becomes a badass, has this awesome lore, but we've never gotten to see it live action.
Right.
We've never gotten to see him really go, like, full tilt. So in this scene, in this battle sequence, they do, they give it to him, and he's just annihilating everyone left and right. You're with armor, without armor, doesn't matter. He is a skilled fighter to be reckoned with.
So they are just wrecking everything, taking out, you know, troops left and right. Moff Gideon cannot be happy. And so we see him actually introduce us in the show to the Dark Troopers, which are, you know, fully robotic, very badass, kind of Darth Vader looking robot stormtroopers. And he sends, you know, a platoon of them down to pretty much snatch up Grogu. And unfortunately, you know, he is successful at that. He takes Grogu and, you know, they blow up the Razor Crest. That was kind of the other big thing there. As they're leaving, they steal Grogu and blow up the Mando's ship. So it kind of forces Mando into a tighter partnership with Boba and Fennec moving forward. You know, now they know that they've got to try and somehow take on this impossible task of getting Grogu back. And I thought kind of the last cool scene here with episode 6, and I don't know if it feeds into my predictions on Grogu or whatnot, but, you know, we get one last scene where they show us Grogu in the cell of the Empire ship, and he's force choking two different stormtroopers at the same time.
Yeah.
And it just felt very Vaderish. You know, it was just like he was like pissed, you know, and he's giving it to him, but they do escape.
They do escape, and they build this nice little honor amongst thieves theme, I think, where because, you know, Mando got Boba his armor back, there is this connection, there's this devotion. He needs to honor what Mando has done for him. You also get a really cool backstory because he's hesitant to give the armor to Boba. And so you finally get a canon version that Jango was given the armor by, you know, the Mandalorian ancestors and fought in the Civil War. And he himself was a foundling as a child. So, like, it instantly makes this connection between, you know, our Mando and Boba Fett's father, Jango. And it kind of ties it all together, gives them a reason to trust one another and to work together moving forward.
Just another little detail, easily overlooked, but is really filling in holes that we've had for, you know, 40 or 50 years in this storytelling. So,
absolutely. Before we move on to the next episode, I kind of want to give a shout out to one of our buddies, Alex, who talked about, like, the name of the episode is The Tragedy.
Okay.
And on the face of it, it would seem that the tragedy is that Grogu has been stolen. But he pointed out that he felt that the tragedy is because the Razor Crest got blown up.
Okay.
And it could be a little bit of both. I wanted to see where you fell on that. Like, what is the bigger tragedy to you? That Grogu was stolen and is now in the hands of the Empire? Or we lost a ship that we had, I don't know, grown accustomed to, like, really started to enjoy it. It became its own character in some ways.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to put it. I don't think I caught that. I don't think I looked at it from that perspective, but I do like that. And I could see that it's perplexing, you know?
Yeah.
I like that. I would be interested to see down the line if, like, Favreau or somebody explained that.
Yeah, like,
and said, you know, okay, you think it's on what we had you focused on, but that one, you know, scene, that one moment where they just blow up the entire ship and it's gone forever, you know, maybe that is the real tragedy. That's pretty astute.
Yeah. And like I said, not an original thought on my end. That definitely comes from our good buddy Alex. But I thought about it because ships and extra things, armor, are so ingrained into Star Wars. You know, the Millennium Falcon, Slave One, X-Wings, Y-Wings, AT-ATs, AT-STs, like, the vehicles in Star Wars are so synonymous with it. So, like, and Razor Crest really started to develop its own lore and history, and then just in an instant, poof, it's taken from us.
Well, and in such a galactic empire type scape, you know, where people travel from planet to planet like we do, city to city here in real life, the fact that you have a spaceship sets you apart from the masses, you know, because there are people that, you know, are born, live, and die on these planets without ever seeing the galaxy, without ever seeing other planets, because you're just so poor or whatever it may be. So if you are, you know, essentially privileged enough or lucky enough to have access or own a spaceship, you're like in a whole other class of people in the galaxy. So that's just kind of one way of looking at it, but it is a big deal because I would imagine, you know, if cars here are $50,000, like I would imagine a spaceship's like a million credits. I don't know. You know?
yeah, a lot. But you're right. Yeah. Thinking of like the Creel farmers from season one, you know, they never left their planet. So yeah, you're right though. You're right.
So that's an interesting thought, but that could be. Mando's going to have to get himself a new ship when we go into the future seasons, I guess. But we are almost wrapped up here with season one, even though there was some serious stuff packed into the last two episodes here. So, of course, Grogu has been taken. They need to find where Moff Gideon's ship is. So, once again, we see Mando, and now with Boba and Fennec, they return to Nevarro. They know they need more help. And specifically, they need now Marshal Cara Dune to go and grab a character that we saw in the first season, Migs Mayfield, played by the comedian Bill Burr, and who was an ex-Imperial that still has some access to their systems, to their data. And so they go and grab him so they can go on kind of an undercover mission into a Imperial base and access, you know, a space terminal so they can find the coordinates for the ship.
Yeah.
It's kind of loose, and it's borderline one of those kind of throwaway episodes in a way, from kind of like how things go down. I thought that as far as the action and everything, it was kind of just more of the same there. We didn't see anything too new or different.
Right.
But it really dived in to the personal side of things, kind of the moral side of things. We see some really interesting decisions or sacrifices that the Mandalorian makes, you know, Din makes, as far as, you know, taking off his armor and you know, some of his code that he is willing to do in order to save this character that he loves, you know, and cares for and has respect for in Grogu. And so that I thought that the highlight here, it was easy to kind of look at some of the cool action scenes that we got, but to me, it was more about the commentary from Bill Burr talking about how, you know, Empire or Republic, Mando or Jedi, whatever, you know, everybody's just doing what they have to do to survive. Who cares what you choose to do as long as you can sleep at night and kind of live with yourself. And, you know, just some of that little bit more gray area that we don't get a whole lot in our faces or really put front and center in Star Wars.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he's got a couple quotes, and they all kind of take place where they've got to sneak into this base. And to do so, Din needs to take off his Mandalorian armor and put on Stormtrooper armor. And as they're driving in through this, you know, they basically take over a tank and then drive into the base. It's all during that drive in, that kind of slowdown period, where he has all these little comments and he's talking about the farmers on the side.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, Imperial or New Republic, it's all the same to these people. You know, it's just one more ruler, one more person at the top. Like, they're just going to go on with their lives. And then the other big thing that he says in that moment was, he says, is your code that you can't take off your helmet or you can't show your face?
Right.
Because there is, there is a difference.
Yes.
And that's like, that's some powerful stuff, because he's right. Like, what is your code? And clearly, everybody has a breaking point. You know, to quote Ted DiBiase, everybody's got a price.
Yeah.
You know, like, but in a sense, like, everybody has been pushed to a limit. And what is your limit to make you break your code?
Yeah, I thought that it was just another perfect example, maybe one of the better ones, you know, just like kind of going back to the Sand People. And if you haven't watched the show, it's, to me at least, it's one of the best aspects of it, is that it is just making everything that much deeper, that much more complex, and taking it from surface level action and side, you know, kind of that we've seen, because some of the old Star Wars movies are kind of surface level, and now really diving into the nuance.
Oh, yeah. It explores areas of gray. And one of the key factors in this particular episode that I noted is that they're trying to get this tank full of Rhydonium into the base, and then pirates attack them. And there's four caravans, four tanks, and they're the only one. You know, Mayfield and Din's tank is the only one that gets into the bank or into the base. And when they get into the base, there's very interesting imagery of the fact that, like, it's the stormtroopers celebrating.
Right.
And it has, like, a little bit of a callback to the rebels celebrating when they blow up the first Death Star and Luke gets out of the X-Wing and everybody's, like, celebrating and happy. It almost is a, like, not shot-for-shot remake, but very similar tone to, like, they're getting out of the tank and, you know, Mayfield with no helmet on sticks his arm up and all the stormtroopers are celebrating and clapping him on the back and shaking their hands. And it's like, it's very interesting that this is very rebel-like.
Right.
But it's the other side.
Right, because everybody's just trying to survive and do what they need to do for the side they're on. And I think it came from the beginning of episode 8. So maybe it'll kind of transition us there. But to your point, there's another good moment like that. It's something that we have seen and heard and talked about as Star Wars fans for years. At the beginning of episode 8, where they go and they finish up episode 7. They are successful on their mission. They're able to grab the codes they need. They know where Moff Gideon is now. They know how to go get Grogu.
Mm-hmm.
So now we come into episode 8, and it's immediately started out with a kind of high-speed space chase of Slave One coming after an Imperial ship that's got the clone doctor on it.
Yeah.
So they're going, trying to snag him so they can get more information and use him to get onto Moff Gideon's ship. And in that moment, when they come in, and they are trying to capture him, the pilot of the ship, he's trying to, you know, I guess be his best Imperial soldier that he can be.
Yeah.
So he's kind of standing off, and there's a couple of lines of dialogue, and Cara Dune, who's with Din now, you know, she was from Alderaan. And if you remember Alderaan, you'll remember that that is the planet that the Death Star blew up,
yeah,
you know, in one of the first movies. And we've always heard how evil the Empire was for destroying a planet and killing millions of people. But in this moment, as Kara is dealing with this, because she's got the little tear kind of marking that she's from Alderaan, the Imperial guy, the Imperial captain, he pretty much throws it the other way.
Yeah.
The 180. And he says, "You all blew up the Death Star. You know how many millions of people you killed that day?"
Yeah.
"You know, my friends." And it was the exact same situation, just on two different sides of the coin.
Yeah.
And we talk about it all the time. I'm a firm believer that most people, you know, whether it's politics or whatever, that most people at brass tacks are going through a lot more similar things and have more similar beliefs than they think they do.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just one of those kinds of moments, right? You know, you think you're all virtuous blowing up the Death Star because they blew up Alderaan, but you both were responsible for the genocide of millions of people, no matter what side they were on.
Yeah.
A lot of those guys at the Empire, man, they were just trying to get a paycheck, you know?
Yeah, just trying to get that. Well, and we saw some of that at the end of episode 7 when Mayfield, you know, sniped the shot and blew up the base and said he had something he wanted to get off his chest.
Yeah.
Clearly, he's got some sort of PTSD from his years in the Empire and what he was made to do. Like, you know, it's a hell of a shot, and that was amazing. But there's some background there that not everybody's on board with this. And, you know, not everybody's just strictly evil,
right,
if you're on the Death Star.
Right.
But you're right. Like, it's awesome because it takes something that, you know, for a long time maybe was a little surface level in Star Wars, and just put some serious depth behind it.
Yeah, and it makes it more discussion worthy.
Yeah.
You know, when you go into these aspects, it complicates things because life is complicated. And you know, it doesn't mean that there aren't people on the right side and the wrong side. There aren't good or bad people out there. But I don't think you can ever really say that things are just how you think they are.
Right.
You know, that group of people are entirely evil, or this group of people is entirely good. It does not work that way in real life, and it does not work that way in Star Wars, now we know. So, anyways, Moving through here, though, episode 8, we could talk about this episode for hours, I'm sure. So we're going to have to try and contain it. But as best I can, we see pretty much the entire crew from the first season and the second season get pulled together. So we've got Cara Dune, we've got Carl Weathers, we've got, you know, Mando, we've got Bo-Katan and her group of Mandalorians. They are all coming together to go after Moff Gideon, save Grogu, and obviously help Boca with some of her, you know, own motivations with the Darksaber and things like that.
Yeah.
Pretty much they are assaulting the ship from the get-go. And it's just one long battle scene between them fighting stormtroopers and dealing with the platoons of dark troopers that are there. We get a fantastic fight scene between Moff Gideon and the Mandalorian that we've been kind of building to for the entire two seasons. And I mean, I think that pretty much every moment of this episode was just an action fan's wet dream. You know, like, how could you not have just been entertained through and through by this episode?
Oh, it's true. Like, there were just so many characters and so many different fighting styles and things happening. One thing I do love is that, like, if anybody ever questions, you know, if Mando asks you for help and then you're slightly questioning it, all he has to do is, they took the kid.
Yeah.
And they immediately, you know, 180, like, yes, okay, I'm in. Yeah. I'll help you. Like, there's something just so magical and drawing about Grogu that, you know, oh, I gotta help him. I gotta help him. But you're right. Like, every part of this, from the Dark Troopers, you know, being powered up and them knowing they have to get into this ship and get Grogu back in X amount of time, because it takes X amount of time for the Dark Troopers to gear up and get full energy, because they draw so much power, you know, to go full force. You get the one-on-one with Mando and one Dark Trooper, and you see how badass they are in combat. And then you move on, you know, as the rest of the crew, they kill all the stormtroopers and work as a team through the ship. Then the one-on-one match-off with Moff Gideon. Like, you're right. Like, every step of the way. It's about an hour-long episode, but it does not disappoint. It just keeps moving forward and elevating upon elevating upon elevating, layers and layers. It's so good.
Yeah, just nonstop. And ultimately, the team, you know, makes their way to the bridge. They take over the ship entirely. Mando is able to overcome Moff Gideon, grabs the Darksaber, saves Grogu, drags his ass up to the bridge to rendezvous with the team, and then out of nowhere, the platoon of Dark Troopers, you know, when all things look pretty good, they essentially come back into the picture and are trying to breach the bridge. Moff thinks he's got it because he thinks that this group of Dark Troopers are going to overwhelm the team of heroes, and then all of a sudden you hear this alert from the bridge, and you see this lone X-Wing come flying in, and I don't know, man, I watched it twice and got so many goosebumps both times seeing this, because you don't quite know what's going to happen, but you got some ideas, because there's a very famous character that always rolls around in a lone X-Wing. And what precedes, I mean, everything from the music in this moment, when it hits kind of that dubstep-y, electronic-y, Star Wars hybrid, you know, soundtrack.
Yeah.
And this character dressed all in black, full hood, can't see his face, but boom, he opens up a familiar green lightsaber and then just proceeds to go just
ham.
Epic level ham. Yeah. And we talked about it. It was so reminiscent of the moment at the end of Rogue One with Vader, just full anger, like, full abilities, full power, wrecking everything in its path. And it is a full highlight of what a Jedi can do. And ultimately, we do find at the end, when he makes his way to the bridge, that it's a young Luke Skywalker in his prime.
Yeah, like prime Luke. And I like that you said the parallels of the Vader scene in Rogue One. And I know everyone on the internet has already put them side by side.
For sure, yeah.
And they clearly matched him up. But seeing him just annihilate the platoon of Dark Troopers in full Jedi mode. Like, oh man, yeah, that's just like a 5-minute sequence you could watch over and over and over, because it's everything you want. I know that when Rogue One came out and the scene with Vader, everyone was pumped because they're like, that's what we wanted to see. We always wanted to see Vader in his prime, like taking things down, not this old Vader and the clumsy lightsaber battle that he had with Obi-Wan in A New Hope. And so it was very much here too. Like, we're seeing Luke, prime Luke, in all his glory, just cutting down the Darksabers, who are a formidable bunch, because you saw what one did to Din.
Yeah, and he takes on at least 20 or 30 of them.
Yeah.
And doesn't even get scratched. I mean, it's not even a contest.
Yeah.
How easily Luke in his prime wrecks, you know, essentially what are like the most powerful soldiers that the Empire has at this point.
Yeah.
And it just, from using the Force, the lightsaber wielding, the music, the tone, everything was just get your heart racing, get the blood pumping, you know.
Yeah.
This is what we're here for. This is what we want in Star Wars. And it's something that we had never been given, you know. And unfortunately, just the way the movies worked out and the timing and stuff with Mark Hamill and his age, you know, it's not something we're going to get out of him.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be something like this with the CGI face or, you know, I know a lot of people are clamoring for Sebastian Stan to play him after Boss Logic threw up that fan art of him, which would be perfect. You know, he's already got a metal arm, you know.
Yeah.
He's got the robotic arm. What,
he does have a robotic arm, and he's in the Disney family.
Exactly, you know. But it was really cool. So, you know, you go from all this action, and it wraps up so well with this incredibly impressive kind of change, right? From, like, intense action and dire straits to really touching and loving and caring, you know, when essentially, you know, the mission is now complete. They found the Jedi to pass Grogu to, so he's with his own people. And after all the morals we've talked about, all the what's your code and what are you going to live by and what's important to you discussions that have happened through the seasons, we see, you know, Din removes his helmet, not only for Grogu to see him before he leaves, because he had never seen his face,
right,
but for everybody that's there. You know, it's like 10 different people who all had never seen his face, and he makes that sacrifice. And I mean, it didn't make me cry, but I mean, if somebody told me that they teared up watching it, I would absolutely understand it and believe it.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a crazy tender moment, you know, as father and son, because that's really what they are. They're a clan of two. And for him to have that moment with Grogu, and you're right, I don't think I quite thought about him that basically right when the scene ends and he has to turn around and everybody's ever worked with also gets to see his face. But it's quite a powerful moment, like, for his code, and that he says, I've clearly broken my code in the past for one reason or another. Maybe I'm on a different path now, and I can take my helmet off. And he has the moment with Grogu. It's very powerful, very tender, and I think it will be a defining moment for The Mandalorian as a show for a long time.
Yeah, and they did a good job, because, you know, you get this like roller coaster of emotions from all that happens in this episode, and pretty much, you know, once that's done and Din and Grogu say their goodbyes, Luke and R2 take him, they fly off, and it literally ends the season. And that right there was all of season two, and it just makes you want, give me more.
Yeah.
Give me season three right now.
Yeah.
You know?
instantly. Now, there was the post-credits scene.
Yeah, and that helped.
But that helped, you know, but that's more of a setup for future stuff than it is, like, for Mandalorian in itself. But you're right, as soon as it ends, you just want to know what's next, because for 16 episodes, for two seasons, we've been on this journey, and it's been a lot about Baby Yoda and Grogu, and he's been quested to return him to his own kind, and this and that, and that quest is complete.
Right.
So where do we go? What is next for the Mandalorian and everyone else?
Yeah, and we have to see, you know, and you mentioned the post-credits scene. I think it's kind of perfect, because that kind of sets up the back half of our discussion here, because after, you know, the credits rolled on episode 8, we get taken back to another familiar location that we've seen before, which is, you know, Hutt Palace.
Yeah.
The old stomping grounds of Jabba the Hutt. We get to see kind of a funny old fat Twi'lek, you know.
Yeah.
Who was the lackey.
Bip Fortuna.
Yeah, Bip Fortuna, you know. But now he's all fat and his horn's all fat and everything like that. Looking like he pretty much took over Jabba's stuff after what happened. I guess, was it in Return of the Jedi when they killed Jabba, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, when Leia chokes him out.
Yeah. And that pretty much set up because they show us that Boba and Fennec, you know, I guess after parting ways with Mando, went right back over here. They kill him. They pretty much wipe out the palace. And then the last scene is Boba sitting on Jabba's throne. And, you know, they tell us the Book of Boba Fett is coming in December of 2021. So that's pretty much, at least as of right now, the next steps in the Mandalorian world, or however we want to call it, the Mando universe at this point. But it sets up the second half of our discussion here, because that was only one of a ton of announcements that we got for Star Wars.
Yeah, oh yeah.
In that Disney investor call. So we want to just take a few minutes here and kind of talk about some of those announcements, some of our reactions. They released some of the new High Republic books and comics, and we got to check out one of those.
So yeah, you're right. Like, not only are, you know, we're getting a bunch of new comics and movies, but these TV shows. And, you know, we'll hit these first, I think, here. That there's a ton of TV shows that are directly spinning out of The Mandalorian. And the big three are Ahsoka, Rangers of the New Republic, and The Book of Boba Fett. So out of those three, which one do you think that you're the most excited for?
That's tough. It's probably a tie between Ahsoka and Book of Boba. You know, obviously we want to see more about Boba, where he's going, or maybe what happened to him after he fell into the Sarlacc pit. So I think there's a lot that's very interesting there.
Yeah.
But for me, still watching through Clone Wars, still learning more about Ahsoka, you know, I think that there's almost more interest there in a way, because, you know, the Jedi are just always kind of the top tier, right? Like,
right.
They just get more interest than almost anybody else, at least to me. So I want to see what they do with both of those shows. And I'm also curious to see, are they going to be kind of miniseries? Are they going to be full tilt, you know, multiple season shows? Or are they going to use them as a way to advance those characters and then bring them back to The Mandalorian?
Oh,
as more developed.
Yeah, and I hadn't thought of that, but now that you've said it, that's what I want. Because I'm thinking of the Arrowverse and kind of how the origins of Legends of Tomorrow, like how I perceived how that show was supposed to work, and then it was so successful that it went on to become its own thing.
It did, yeah.
But like that was meant to be almost an extension of these side characters that we saw in various Arrowverse shows, and then they got their own spotlight, highlighted them, and then they could weave back in. But you're right, it could be very interesting. I'm intrigued on how much Boba is going to intertwine with Mando, because Mando spends so much time on Tatooine.
Yeah.
And now Boba Fett is the, you know, the crime lord of Tatooine. And then I think also Ahsoka, her journey is going to be interesting, because she's clearly chasing Admiral Thrawn.
Right.
And what we saw kind of after her episode in Mandalorian. So who knows? I think the one that ties into Mandalorian the most, or should, is Rangers of the New Republic. Because all signs point to it basically being the Cara Dune show.
Right, yeah. And I mean, she has been a key character, even more so than Boba or Ahsoka, for both seasons of Mando.
Yeah, and so we'll see how each of them play out. They all have very unique kind of spots to them, whether it is, you know, Ahsoka and her hunt for Grand Admiral Thrawn, what is Boba going to do as the new crime lord, and then, you know, what is Rangers of the New Republic? Is it about that one X-Wing pilot that we kept seeing over and over? Or is it about Cara Dune, and is Mayfield going to come back for that? So there's a lot of hints, you know, as far as the future of this particular timeline.
Yeah.
Because the other shows that Star Wars are debuting are from previous time, like previous periods in the Star Wars timeline, one being the big one, the Obi-Wan Kenobi show.
Yeah, and I have to say, I put it down here that I'm really pumped for that, and I And I think that it's good that they said already that it's going to be a miniseries, that we know that that show is not planned to be a, you know, season over season situation. But they've got some interesting announcements in there, right? They announced that they're bringing back Hayden Christensen, who was, you know, young Anakin.
Yep.
And it's Skywalker related, so you know how I feel about that. But they could really do some cool things here. And we'll have to see, because, I mean, Hayden Christensen's much older. You know, Ewan McGregor is much older. So what versions of them are we going to get versus maybe some CGI stuff? We'll have to see. But what I think is most interesting is that they could really kind of fill in some holes with this show. Bringing Hayden back, we could see more of the transformation between or from Anakin to Vader, you know, that we didn't get but little bits and pieces of.
Yeah.
We could also now see that we've got Ahsoka. They could fit Ahsoka into this show, depending on how they do it, and give us at least a few scenes where she is with Anakin and Obi-Wan, because in Clone Wars, you see that, you know, Obi-Wan knows who Ahsoka is. They all work together and interact.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a thought I had after thinking about it and seeing Ahsoka. If they want to kind of establish some of these things that happened in Clone Wars with this character, maybe a cameo or two pops in there. Maybe not, but that's just my thought.
It could work. I feel bad. I'm about to do a tea again. And Ahsoka pops up in Rebels.
Okay.
And so does Vader.
So you get some of it there?
You get a little bit of it there. Okay. You get a little bit of it there. Not a lot. And that's probably all I'll say, because I feel really bad about what I did earlier.
Jeez, the other Kyle. Interesting...
I know. I like ruined Clone Wars for Chris. But the other interesting thing that has been announced about Obi-Wan is that it's 10 years after Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
So it's that perfect time period that you're talking about. Like in Vader becoming Vader.
Right.
Like really coming into the mechanical body and everything else. So getting to see the Vader that we saw in Rogue One.
Right. Yep.
You know, how does that get there? And speaking of Rogue One, another new show that I think I'm super hyped about because I loved Rogue One was Andor.
Yeah.
That's going to follow the adventures of Cassian Andor in becoming part of the rebellion and becoming part of the cause, because that was part of his backstory in Rogue One. The other cool announcement about this is the return of K2.
Yeah.
The droid. Yeah. His reprogrammed, you know, Imperial droid that was voiced by Alan Tudyk. So I think that could be fun, you know, seeing basically how the rebellion got started, you know, type deal.
Yeah, I have a lot of high hopes for a lot of these shows. I mean, ultimately, just a numbers thing, right? They're probably not all going to work perfect, you know, because they announced, what, like almost a dozen different spinoffs and shows. And I mean, there's the...
Oh, yeah.
There's a Bad Batch. There's a droid story. There's the Lando Calrissian, whatever that's going to be.
Yeah.
And honestly, I'm not as interested in some of those, even though I'll probably watch them or give them a try. There's also that Rogue... They're making a Rogue Squadron movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I understand how that's going to work, because even though the space battles are awesome, and of course there was a Rogue Squadron video game and stuff like that, you know, the pilots, and we saw it with, what's his name, from The Force Awakens, Poe.
Yeah.
You know, like, they're just only so interesting.
Yeah.
You know, so to make an entire movie around something like that, we're going to have to see how they do that. So there's some kind of questionable items in there that I think could go either way. But the key ones that we talked about there at the beginning, and maybe this new Taika Waititi trilogy movie series that we're going to get, because he's been great. You know, could be awesome. So it's kind of a blend between all the announcements there, as far as some seem like for sure they'll be solid.
Yeah.
Others we'll just have to feel out.
Well, it'd be cool to see, because a lot of the directors that have participated in various episodes of The Mandalorian are getting like action in this next era. So
true.
We're seeing, you know, in Deborah Chow is the main director of the Obi-Wan show. You know, and she did a couple episodes of The Mandalorian. The other big project is Rian Johnson. His trilogy hasn't been canned yet.
Right, which is kind of interesting.
Not officially. Like, I know that Last Jedi divides fans a lot, and Rian Johnson in general divides fans a lot, but that's also out there. Patty Jenkins is the director set to do Rogue Squadron. She's the director of Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
So a lot of intrigue, a lot of things going on. You never know. The last TV show, and this will move us into the High Republic, is The Acolyte.
Yes.
And that is cemented to be set in the High Republic era. That is the new era of Star Wars universe that kind of debuted in January here with a couple books and definitely a couple comic books. And it's all hundreds of years before Phantom Menace.
Yeah. So think about like the golden age of the Jedi and the Sith, like where there are thousands of them running around the galaxy.
Yeah. And what we've heard is the High Republic is meant to be an era of like gray.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the cookie cutter Jedi are good, Sith are bad, you know, and this is what is good and evil. It should be blurred a little bit, which is what we've gotten in Mando.
Right.
So I'm really excited to see more of it. I'm also super excited because Leslie Headland, who is the creator of Russian Doll on Netflix, is the person that is leading the charge on The Acolyte.
That's cool. I don't think I caught that, but they said it's going to be a mystery thriller,
mm-hmm.
really focused on, I think the tweet they put out or the statement they put out was, mystery thriller focused on emerging dark side powers in the final days of the High Republic. So literally this would be all right before the Phantom Menace happened. And you know, the idea of a mystery thriller horror kind of thing going on with Star Wars is really interesting. Seeing the dark side and how that really came to be, maybe a little bit of more Palpatine, you know, Darth Sidious kind of backstories could come into there. So I'm with you. Outside of the stuff that, you know, is obviously front and center with Ahsoka and Boba, I think The Acolyte, out of the new stuff, you know, the unknown stuff, for me, caught my attention the most.
Yeah. Well, and I might know why. It's like the deep disdain for the Skywalker trilogy.
True.
So
it's true.
But I'm right there with you. I'm excited to see
them. There's much hate in me.
Yeah. Maybe you're just afraid. And it's led to this.
It's led to the dark side.
It's led to the dark side, Chris. No, but I think they're taking the best things we like about Star Wars.
Yeah.
We love the lore. We love what you've done with this galaxy, and give us alternate stories. And it's probably why The Mandalorian is so successful and why there's so much hype for us around the High Republic.
Yeah. And the High Republic is pretty cool. You know, we obviously haven't had a chance to read the 3 full-size books that they released, but we did get to check out issue 1 of the first comic. And mm-hmm. and maybe we'll kind of wrap up here with some of our thoughts there. I don't know. I don't believe issue 2 has come out, or at least I haven't read issue 2 yet.
Not yet, yeah.
But it's an interesting point in time. It's something kind of makes me hearken back to, you know, Knights of the Old Republic, the video game,
mm-hmm.
and how much, you know, a lot of us have always said we'd like to see something on screen based on that video game, because it did give us that period of time that everybody's always been so interested in. I have kind of a light prediction. I won't go too hard here, but I do think that with the push of the High Republic, that at least one of these movie trilogies is going to be based on it.
Oh, okay.
Like, it seems like they are kind of all in, and it's really one of the bigger new, like, Star Wars IP adds to the canon kind of moves that we've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
And it feels like they're putting a lot of weight behind it. So I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe this is how I should put it, is I would not be surprised personally if they announced, like, Taika's new trilogy or something was going to be based on the High Republic stuff that they are launching here this year.
Oh, I could definitely see that happening. Absolutely could see that happening, because I know once they got away from the Skywalker saga, they wanted to open the door to new stories and
exactly
kind of start doing almost the Marvel formula in some aspects, where you get a yearly Star Wars release of some kind, whether it is, you know, the new Obi-Wan stuff, or a High Republic movie, or a Rian Johnson-based trilogy, Rogue Squadron, whatever. And I think they're going to need it. They're going to need one of these trilogies to be set in a different time period, or keeping things canon and neat and tight
yeah.
is going to be too difficult. But if you can put something you know, 400 years earlier. It opens the door for new characters, new styles.
To do whatever you want. Everything.
Yeah. Yeah, do whatever you want.
You're not beholden to anything. And yeah. I think that we saw that here in with the High Republic number one.
Yeah.
We picked that up. We both read it. You know, it was almost entirely new characters, new places and things like that. But, you know, they still had a cameo in there. We got to see Master Yoda, a younger
Master Yoda
make an appearance.
Not on the council.
Right.
Master Yoda, somebody that is chosen to remove himself from the council.
Yeah.
There you go.
He's a little, feisty, kind of doing his thing. And so I thought that just seeing that first comic was pretty cool. I didn't expect him to be pulled in so early, but, you know, if you're trying to build some hype, I guess, you know, give him an appearance and something like this gives it some more credibility.
Yeah. Sell a few variant covers.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. They were good variants. You know, the covers have been good. But what were your thoughts on High Republic number one?
I really enjoyed it. I didn't think it was anything groundbreaking. You know, it didn't come out the gate and kick me in the face as far as sometimes number ones can do. But it set up a solid premise, like just all around following a Jedi Padawan, Keeve Trennis, and she's taking her trials to become a Jedi Knight.
Yep.
And so we see that the trials play out, and then ultimately she does get knighted. So it sets up a lot of things moving forward that they can do, because they've got this young Jedi who isn't, you know, stuck in her ideals. Her master, who we also see here, he's a little iffy.
Right.
You know, he's a little more of a Qui-Gon Jinn type character, where he's not stuck into the hardcore code of the Jedi. He sees the world as it is, not as, you know, they dream it to be. And then, you know, I know there's another huge aspect to the comic with the Starlight Beacon.
Yeah, and what they're doing.
That's really cool. Yeah, what they're doing with the Starlight Beacon.
Yeah, I agree there. I like the Qui-Gon comparison. I don't think I put that together personally, but that is a good one. As soon as you said that, I have to agree there. That is definitely what her master kind of gives off. Not carbon copy by any means, and he's more of like a Bosk, you know, like lizard type character, like Bosk the bounty hunter.
He's a I forgot the name of that.
Yeah, it's escaping it's
star-
me.
The Star Wars,
but they're like the lizard dragony looking race.
Yeah,
and all that. But yeah, I had it as good, not great. Definitely good enough to want to read through at least, you know, the first six, maybe the first 12, and let it develop and kind of mature into what it's going to be. But the art was cool. It was very kid-friendly, but that's kind of Star Wars, right? Like, almost all Star Wars is going to be pretty friendly for kids, but it didn't feel like it was made specifically for that demographic, per se.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of talk when they were promoting the new books and the comics as kind of a young adult range, and it probably lined up with that pretty good for the comic that we read, but it didn't turn me off is what I'm getting at. As an older fan and all of that, you know, it didn't turn me off because there was still good action, still some interesting characters, and what they're doing with this beacon out on like the rim of the galaxy to try and attract, you know, other people or give those parts of the galaxy hope, you know, had some cool aspects to it. So we'll have to see where it goes. I'm definitely anxiously awaiting number two.
Yeah, I believe it comes out in the first week of February. So we'll see, you know, where they take this story and how they develop the rest of these characters and shape a very, for us, young Jedi Council. Of course, they've been around for millennia, but, you know, we're finally getting to see a different era of Jedi that maybe have a different mentality and are not so stuck in their ways,
right,
as the ones we're familiar with.
Yeah, and I guess we should throw out there, I know, like we mentioned, I hadn't read the books yet, but I did read some reviews, and the books themselves have gotten some pretty decent praise right off the bat.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't see anything that was really too negative or too critical. I mean, it seemed like they were entertaining, good, you know, good characters, the whole nine yards, so maybe at some point I'll try and pick those up, but you, knowing us, we're more into the comic side of things, so with the fact that they actually released comics to go along with all this, I think we both kind of felt like that was a little bit of the better play.
Yeah, for us. But I'm excited to see canon books come back into play because they've always been such a key part to Star Wars lore over the years, you know, the legends and all of that. But it's hard to believe that less than 2 years ago, The Mandalorian didn't exist. Yet here we stand 16 episodes later, and it's already ingrained itself at the core of the Star Wars universe with its introduction of new characters, themes, and lore. And we, along with every other Star Wars fans, are excited to see where the show goes, as well as the rest of the Star Wars universe.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this chapter, be sure to hit the subscribe button to get new chapters of Geek Ketchup every 2 weeks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Be sure to follow the show on social media. And you can find us on Facebook and YouTube at Geek Ketchup Podcast, or on Twitter and Instagram at Geek Ketchup Pod. Links to all these accounts are in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. Stay saucy, you nerds.